we're back. At any cost. At any cost.
What is this?
Is this a what if thing?
It's from What If. I keep saying at any cost.
Can I tell you, I watched the trailer. Like, I pulled up my Netflix. I saw Renee Zellweger. I thought, oh, what's she been up to? Her hair looks good. I watched the trailer and I was like, I don't know what this is about. Like, the trailer told me nothing.
You don't know what it's about from the trailer?
No.
Basically, you find out towards the end of the pilot, and I'm not spoiling anything because, like, this is the series, and they don't tell you what it is in the trailer. It's Indecent Proposal, the show. So in order for Jane Levy, who was in Suburgatory, which I loved, she has a pharmaceutical company that she's trying to keep afloat. And Renee Zellweger is incredibly wealthy. And she says that she wants one night with her husband, and then she will give her $80 million
what?
For her company.
There is not a man on earth worth $80 million.
Also, this show looks like an evil perfume commercial or something.
Yes, it's Renee Zellweger staring out a lot of windows at CGI San Francisco, and also CGI lightning. It's from the creator of Revenge.
Oh, okay.
So there's a lot of window staring.
I saw a lot of hot people looking distressed.
Mm-hmm.
And
her husband is played by Blake Jenner.
I don't know.
He was in Glee briefly.
Okay. Right.
He was also at High Tops yesterday.
Oh, really?
Just having a good time.
That's a bar here in West Hollywood. Well,
it's a sports bar, so like straight people feel comfortable matriculating it.
Also, it seems like this show, maybe Renee Zellweger is secretly only in 1/5 of it.
Yeah, so part of the problem, too, I enjoy it. It's messy. It's over the top. It could be more like You with, like, things actually happening each episode. It's moving kind of slowly. She seems to be in, like, 20% of each episode.
No.
It seems like they filmed her scenes in a block because they didn't have her for the whole time.
From Cold Mountain to Hot Mess Mountain.
And then there are supporting characters, and they're kind of the worst. There's this black woman who's a doctor who's having an affair, and there is this gay couple that's trying to decide whether or not they should have a threesome.
Compare this show to You. Is You give you more on the camp?
Yes, okay. Yes.
You is at least, even if You is not, like, even, You is at least funny. Like, yeah. I found You hilarious. I don't think that was the intention
right.
of the show.
Of the
but,
artist.
Yes, but I found it very funny. And so at least you can take something from it.
I think there were jokes in You.
I found the she's the dumbest woman on the island of Manhattan.
Yes.
I was like, that is what I found funny.
What If is more, you know, if you love like a campy, like, nighttime soap that's trying to be Shonda, but isn't, sure.
Kind of rhymes.
Yeah. You know, Beige Anatomy. But speaking of messy, did y'all see what happened with Moby and Natalie Portman this week?
I did.
Yeah. Two people who I just almost never think about.
I think about Natalie Portman often.
I'm certainly not like, I don't dislike her by any means, but she's never been in anything that I've really loved. So I don't have a lot of, I'm like, yeah, Natalie Portman. Okay. Sure. I don't feel strongly.
I think among like preeminent actresses, she's like one of the radder people. Like she's just like actually outspoken and tends to know what she's talking about. But this, I mean, this pairing of people, just, you know, the famous Enya Joseph Gordon-Levitt feud, just completely strange.
I feel like I love Jackie. And I love
like Jackie. I'd never totally got Jackie.
I love Jackie, you know, but that's my
speaking of there. Fancy perfume commercials masquerading as movies.
But Moby, I guess, has this book out and
like a memoir.
Yeah. And he's talking about the early 90s and the late 90s and, you know, him being a vegan or what have you.
And body rock.
I know, right? I also, during all of this, I like revisited some Moby songs and I was like, oh, they were good.
Right.
Some of them.
Well, they were in every commercial ever.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
You could not stop hearing him.
But he talks about how he had a relationship with Natalie Portman when she was 20 and he was older. And then she came out and was like, first of all, I was 18. You could have fact checked this. And we were never in a relationship. And then he was like, oh no, girl, here I have a photo of us together somewhere. So clearly we're dating.
Read it and weep.
Then he like tripled down again on like Instagram before finally apologizing.
Though his apology had something weird in it. Did you see that he apologized, but then at the end he goes, I acknowledge that I should have behaved differently despite our almost 14-year age difference, when in fact they are 16 years apart. So it's I don't know if that was intentional, if he's being like, I know that she's secretly older or younger than she said, older than she says.
Yeah,
anyway,
I think
it was very
he
strange.
Doesn't count.
Yeah, it could be.
I don't know.
Also, Moby, I mean, man, this ain't the Hill.
No.
Dating Natalie Portman, is that a hill that you want to die on?
Yeah, I don't think that's the one you want, man.
Do you remember when Jonathan Safran Foer?
Oh my God, the emails.
No.
Because he was in love with Natalie Portman?
Oh, right. Yes. I actually, you would think there'd be more like memoir-related issues of this type. Like, you know, someone says something and they don't, because this isn't the kind of thing where like the New York fact checker is like checking in with everybody that, you know, Angelica Houston badmouths in her new book or whatever.
I feel like.
But someone wrote, the thing is, someone at the publishing company, like someone should have fact checked that book. Like whether or not like there should have been an individual before you fucking publish a book.
Hey, Natalie,
yeah.
Did this happen? How old were you? That seems like just something you could easily Google.
Yeah.
But also, I feel like a lot of those memoirs that are really juicy happen when a lot of the other people in the book are dead.
Totally. Yeah.
So you can really get those secrets out.
You know, the sad thing now is this exact type of mix-up we can't do anymore because everything is so documented. Mm-hmm. So, like, if they had dated now, we'd be like, well, we have the Instagram stories of you two going to Avengers.
Yeah.
So, can't really lie here.
We've got them DMs about what you really said.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway.
Do you think he gets into the racial politics of Southside with Gwen Stefani? Because it's on my mind sometimes. Don't they have weapons in hand as we start to drive? I mean, what's going on there?
I doubt it. I doubt it. We have a ridiculous show for you today. It's a lot of Harvey Weinstein content today. A lot of people who were part of the Harvey clan will be brought up today. But we're going to be talking about his settlement, his $44 million settlement. We will also be talking about Quentin Tarantino. Former friend of Harvey Weinstein. And, you know, we'll also get into Booksmart and why people don't go to the movies anymore. We'll be joined by Kyle Buchanan of the New York Times, if you've heard of that paper.
Maybe.
The paper of record.
The gray lady, yes.
The failing New York Times.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. The lion fake news New York Times. We will be right back. Justice is a dish best served as a very complicated legal proceeding. Last Thursday, it was announced that Harvey Weinstein, his company, and former associates had reached a tentative $44 million settlement to resolve the civil lawsuits over his sexual misconduct. The lawsuit will settle New York State's civil suit, as well as lawsuits from various women and former employees against Harvey and his company. The money from the tentative settlement would be paid out to and shared among his alleged victims, as well as creditors and company associates. Due to the nature of Weinstein's company's bankruptcy filing, insurance companies will be paying out this settlement and not Weinstein himself.
Oh, I love that.
A judge will either approve or disapprove of these terms next week. While this portion of his legal woes are likely coming to an end, he still faces criminal charges for rape.
The amount of people who are collecting this $44 million, it's like winning a day of HQ. Like, everybody wins 17 cents.
I know. It's wild because they were supposed to be getting more. You know, there was initially going to be a buyout of the Weinstein Company, which did not go through, but it would have been about $90 million, you know, and now they have to settle for less. And Megyn Kelly, author of Settle for More, the 2016 memoir, would not agree with that, I'm sure.
You know, it's a good, and I have said this over and over, my complete lack of faith in any of these men, except for the small handful that will likely go to actual prison, mm-hmm. holding any real, you know, having any real accountability, because it's like, you also realize what rich people have set up to protect themselves. So the fact that they're an insurance company is paying, it's like, that happens, of course they have that, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? In the way that someone less powerful than him would have been on the hook for that, wouldn't have been able to pay it anyway. But like, he could have paid the $44 million. Like, I feel like if you had forced him, I feel like he had $44 million.
I feel like he's spending that much on, you know, like junior mints and spa dates right yeah. now.
But it's depressing. Even when you're like, oh, look, something's happening, but you're like, oh, he still isn't really responsible for it.
No, I don't think anybody is coming out of this Weinstein case being like, God, I sure hope all he has to do is pay people money. Like, I'm sure that's what he's done for years and years. It's like a disgusting idea that, like, it's just another form of making it go away, which is what he has done successfully for, you know, decades at this point, I'm sure. But no, I mean, like, it's nice that people will be collecting money, but I think what he's taken away from a lot of these people is just quality time in their lives, and that's what should be subtracted from his own life.
75,000 ain't gonna do it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, because first of all, only 30 million is going to be split by the accusers. 14 million will be allocated to the legal fees of Mr. Weinstein's associates, including former board members of his company who were named as defendants in the suit.
Okay.
It's important to know that this is like, I'll guess, like 1/9 of the full onslaught of things occurring against Harvey Weinstein. But really, there's just no joy in the idea of him getting money to people. You know?
Yeah. But he's still facing those criminal charges.
Yeah.
So he's still facing criminal charges in New York for allegations of sexual violence against two women. He's accused of raping a woman in a New York hotel room in 2013 and forcibly performing oral sex on another woman. And he also faces two counts of predatory sexual assault, one count of a criminal sexual act in the first degree, one count of first degree rape, and one count of third degree rape.
God damn.
I have not heard a sentence like that since an SVU marathon. and usually they get off and someone gets murdered and Olivia Benson looks sad at the end. Also, Ashley Judd took to Twitter to reassure the public that her lawsuits against Weinstein are not over. Ashley Judd tweeted, "My lawsuit against hashtag Harvey Weinstein is ongoing and I intend to take him to trial. Hashtag Me Too. Hashtag Me Too movement." And then she later added that she is not a party to any of the settlement.
Good. It's just this thing too when these guys... it's all sort of happened so late. Mm-hmm. Even if he, like, let's say he goes to prison for these rapes, you're still like, wow, you lived decades as a rich, successful person. Like, you're probably going to, like, it was sort of, I remember Joe Paterno when, like, shit started getting hot and he just died.
Right.
Where I was like, okay, you definitely knew that dude was raping all those kids and he was super old, which is what I sort of thought Bill Cosby would do. I thought Bill Cosby was just going to die. Mm-hmm. He's like, I'm old. I don't want to go to jail. I'm just going to be done with this.
Instead, I think he just went blind in prison and is now solving crimes on the CW.
He was blind. He was going blind before that. But even when they end up in prison, there's such a lack of satisfaction because you're like, Bill Cosby got to live most of his life without any repercussions as a wealthy, beloved, famous person with all of this privilege. Joe Paterno got to live as a hero. I mean, I know he's not Jerry Sandusky, but, you know, and that's different shit. But still, and Harvey Weinstein got to live most of his life just fine. And even if he does go to jail, you know, whatever, he's 60-something years old. Like, it's, it just
the
doesn't 90s have
and 2000s
the...
were his heyday.
Yeah,
you know?
It just...
He had all the fun he was going
to
have.
And also, he had just basically a delivery system of women to him.
Yeah, and he's probably, you know, like, if he goes to jail, you're like, how long is he really going to live? Like, I imagine him just, like, dying at 74 and, like, okay, that was over. But still, most of your life, you lived without any punishment. And it's just, it's the scenario that you want is not possible. You want him to have been caught doing this shit 20 years ago. But it still just doesn't leave, you know, like, I don't think with any of these this sort of feeling of like justice. Mm-hmm. Ah, we feel like we did it. Will ever happen.
Yeah. You know, I mean, and sometimes there's this idea, I guess, that a settlement can maybe feel better for a victim, you know, instead of having to stand a trial and relive the entire situation. But, you know, even this settlement, it just feels like it's sort of nothing, you know?
Yeah.
It feels like not a real settlement awarded that makes a statement that he really did anything wrong. Like, I mean,
it's like putting a band-aid on a trauma.
He's not even fucking paying it. So,
yeah. I mean, it's not, you know, something like the Central Park Five where you're like, you robbed these kids of their time. This money that you're getting is, in a way, it's to make up for that time that's lost. And obviously the trauma of it, you can't fix that. But that feels a little bit more satisfying in a way. And in particular, because this is like, it's criminal shit. Mm-hmm. So it's like, no matter what, the best punishment for criminal, you know, whatever, the most apt punishment for criminal behavior is jail or prison. And so the money thing is just, that's not how we think of making up for criminal behavior. Mm-hmm. You know, families were like, someone, you know, your loved one is murdered. You're not like, the thing that brought me peace was the $20 million settlement. It was like knowing that this person can't do this to someone else, or that they've, you know, they've been punished in a way that feels appropriate to me.
Well, and also, you know, bringing up even like the Central Park Five or someone getting a settlement for, you know, like a family member who's been killed or something, that is like one person or like five people, right? Like Harvey Weinstein has so many victims that even this amount, like, it sort of feels like nothing, and settlements like that should be to, you know, you've lost part of your life, you know, like maybe you weren't able to pay bills in that time period. Maybe you needed like extensive therapy, other things that you like really need to take care of. And I don't think the piddly money that's going to go to these people from the settlement is going to help them with anything that they've had to deal with over the past few years since Harvey assaulted them. You know, it's like people who lost careers or like had to leave the industry or anything like that. Like, you can't rebuild that with, you know, $70,000.
I feel like Ashley Judd's trial will be there'll be this criminal trial in the fall, but hers where she's like, it's like defamation, right? It's like, you fucked up my career. And I think, you know, unfortunately too, because she's someone that we're familiar with and you know, I think that trial will probably be the one where most people, you know, depending which way it goes, feels the most sort of catharsis of, okay, he got what was coming to him, because it's the most representative of what he did, which was not only just assaulting women, but also ruining their careers and undermining them in that way. And so I feel like she'll be kind of that, the avatar for the feeling that we all want, which is like, that's what we want him punished for.
Also, I think there's something particularly unsatisfying about the fact that this kind of money settlement doesn't do anything to disassemble the system that kept him afloat. You know what I mean? It's just like, oh, we're knocking off the kingpin and nothing else, you know?
Yeah. No, there's really no sort of talk about what's going to happen with the people who sort of enabled him. And we'll get to one of those people later in this episode. But, you know, also just the whole Hollywood ecosystem, and it's been, what is it, like almost 2 years now since this Me Too movement has happened. And when you're only seeing that this now is all that's happening to Harvey, it's like, girl, what's changed?
You want to know for real what I bet the biggest change will be within the industry is these studios and production companies will take out larger insurance policies.
Yeah.
To be honest, they're like, oh shit, we just need to make sure that like someone else will have to pay when inevitably one of these fucking men puts their hands on someone.
Right. Well, that's life affirming.
Yeah.
The other disheartening thing is that the studios probably know exactly who they need to take these life insurance.
Oh yeah, there's
exactly
like a
list. Exactly who they need to take these insurance policies out on, because there's probably stories or like minor complaints that have come up before, and they're like, cool, well, let's gird our loins before anything else happens.
Yeah. Or rewrite the contract, like a sort of Les Moonves situation where it's like, how do we just make sure we don't have to pay him his money when we have to fire him finally after a very long time?
Well, I guess we did not get him, as Rose McGowan thought.
All right. How's she doing? I haven't heard from her in a while.
I don't know. A tweeting with Alyssa Milano.
Oh, they're not friends, but
oh, that's right.
She had the Was she the one with the younger man situation?
That's Asia Argento.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Yeah. So
don't want to get into any of that.
Yeah, no.
A lot of franchise spinoffs from this Harvey Weinstein situation. When we're back, we will be talking to Kyle Buchanan of the New York Times about Cannes and Quentin Tarantino.
Save big on your landscaping project now at Menards. Whether you're installing a patio or a new retaining wall, Menards has the blocks you need to get the job done right. We carry the largest in-stock selection ready to take home today. Stop in and get our 12-inch smooth patio block on sale now. Save big on concrete landscape blocks at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Bonjour. Welcome back. The fanciest French party that we definitely were not invited to.
Speak for yourself. Actually, it's true. Go ahead.
Lewis has a standing invite to Cannes.
Right.
he's just too busy.
Sorry, Elle Fanning. Couldn't make it.
The 72nd annual Cannes Film Festival in France wrapped up last week with the jury president, Alejandro Iñárritu, announcing the group's unanimous decision to award the Palme d'Or to Bong Joon-ho, a South Korean director, for his film Parasite.
Words there you just used.
You know, I like some of his movies. He did Snowpiercer.
Snowpiercer. Did I like it? I liked performances in it. Anyway, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I liked Okja. Parts of it.
Didn't like Okja.
Okay. Well, parts of it. What I saw.
Tilda was, of course, wonderful.
While I was cooking dinner. Anyway, today, to talk about all of this, we have the New York Times carpetbagger columnist, Kyle Buchanan, here with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, Kyle.
I'm happy to be here.
Fresh off the plane.
Fresh. Well, we're losing that. You were using that word loosely. Okay, so Parasite. Let's talk about this right away, because exactly that reaction you had where you're sort of saying, well, I like this Bong Joon-ho film. I don't know about this one. Mm-hmm. This is the first one where I could recommend it to just about anybody because it is that good. Like, it's amazing. Ira, you'll love it. It's about a family of scammers.
Great.
But yeah, it's this wonderful movie that won the Palme d'Or. It's kind of exciting and genre-ish. It's about, this family, this father, son, wife, daughter, and they all kind of scam their way into a rich family's home and sort of take up residence there and turn the household upside down. And it's almost too easy for the first hour, leading you to believe that something is going to go down and something does. And then it becomes deeper. It's like this roller coaster ride where you're never quite sure where it's going to end up. And it's just, it's so good. I'm so psyched that it actually won the Palme because it doesn't always go to the best film there.
Yeah.
And I can't wait for people to see it.
I'm so psyched about Korean movies about scammers. I wish that more people had seen The Handmaid.
Oh, my. Yeah. The Handmaiden is amazing.
Yeah.
No Korean film has ever been nominated for Best Foreign Film at the Oscars, which is crazy. But
that
I think that
bizarre.
This one is going to not just get nominated for that, but hopefully Best Director even.
So
it's so good.
It'll be at the AMC next week.
We'll see.
So for our listeners, who, unlike me, don't extensively vacation en Paris in my pied-à-terre, what is Cannes? What is the Palme d'Or?
Yeah.
And why is it so prestigious?
So the Cannes Film Festival is this big film festival in May. It's kind of the cream of the crop of world cinema. When you're thinking of film festivals that happen throughout the year, there's Sundance in January. That's where all the independent films happen. It's in Utah. It's snowy. You've got Cannes in May. That's where, it's in the south of France. It's gorgeous and tends to be sort of like these big established directors. And then you've got Toronto and Telluride and all those in the fall, which are all the Oscar movies.
And also, I would say Cannes is a very seen and be seen type festival where it's just the glamour level is extreme.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're not going to get a lot of glamour in Sundance where everybody is wearing snow boots.
Right, Andy McDowell has jodhpurs.
Well, I mean, I find that glamorous.
Can you please explain to me why Kendall Jenner was there?
Yeah, well, Kendall Jenner is there almost every year, which
is
very
weird.
Yes, she is. Kendall Jenner and Eva Longoria.
The people that I see on the carpet, I saw like Winnie Harlow, who looked great, but just people where I'm like, you're not a filmmaker, you're not an actor, and you're not even really in that set. of people. Like, they're just, you're like, I like Naomi Campbell to me rolls up anywhere and you're like, I don't know why she's here. She has nothing to do with any of this, but I believe that everyone there is interested in her being there. I don't know that the same, I could say the same for Kendall Jenner. Like, who's she talking to at these parties?
Well, I think Ken is kind of the Miami of France. Right? So like, you're going to get some Miami type celebrities. Yes. Like, it is incredibly glamorous. Like, the most ridiculous things that you could do, you know, these yacht parties, or sometimes you take a helicopter to a party. It's really absurd, like lavish in the extreme.
Crazy rich film bloggers.
No, you feel, I mean, at least I do, like I'm a secret agent who's undercover for 2 weeks wearing a tuxedo every day, which is just an absurd, like not usually part of my experience. I am the type of person who just buys a Slim Jim at the gas station and eats it for lunch, you know, and now I'm eating caviar. It's crazy.
Right. But so yeah, there's dress codes too and things, right? Because well, so, I remember that uproar where Kristen Stewart was like, she didn't want to wear heels there.
Yeah. Well, where she wears sneakers. No, the dress code is, I mean, that's another one of the things that's so extreme. In order to get into these premieres, every man has to be wearing a tux with a bow tie, and the women are supposedly not allowed to even wear flats. You've got to be in high heels, and you've got to be wearing a dress. Now, obviously, people like Kristen Stewart have been challenging that, but people who aren't as famous as Kristen Stewart, they still will ding you for it. I mean, I remember even a couple years ago, Zachary Quinto produced this movie, All Is Lost, with Robert Redford. Hmm. He went to his own premiere of the movie that he had produced, and he goes up there, I think he was wearing, I'm not sure if it was like a bolo tie or just like a regular tie, and they said, sir, we cannot let you in. You're not wearing a bow tie. And he's like, I've produced this movie. It's about to premiere in 10 minutes. And they said, well, go across the street and buy a bow tie. There's Gucci.
Wow.
Yeah. And I mean, on some level, you've got to sort of respect it, because that is crazy to like hold the extreme. Like, I mean, when we think of the glamour of Cannes, when you see those pictures of Elle Fanning on that incredible red carpet,
I don't know what she was promoting, but she was promoting herself.
She was on the jury. Yeah. Which, oh, okay. You know, and she came there like, listen, I'm going to be photographed seeing these films every day. I want it to be a major moment. And she used that red carpet wisely. But yeah, I mean, that is how crazy it is.
Does it make the movies better?
To see everybody in their best finery?
Do you feel that sitting, watching a movie in a tuxedo, that has enhanced your movie viewing?
It's a good question. You know, I mean, like, to some extent, maybe there's more of a buy-in because you, like, got dressed up for it. But, you know, it's kind of like, if you look at Cannes holistically, it is this, you know, high holy temple of cinema. You know, you, like, pronounce the ma part of cinema. And they uphold that by, you know, having all of these standards and crazy restrictions, and it's like very old school glamour. The downside of that is like the movie industry is changing. Mm-hmm. It is changing so fast. And in some ways, Cannes can be left behind by that, you know, until recently, and still even, they've had real problems when it comes to representation, when it comes to female filmmakers. They don't buy in on these people like, you know, a Sundance Film Festival where half of their competition is female filmmakers does. So Cannes has a lot of ground to make up. And I think that when you have those old school attitudes and you're really, you know, you're prioritizing that presentation, maybe you're letting a couple other things pass you by.
Here's my question about Cannes. I feel like a major part of the press that comes out of Cannes is literally what films got standing ovations.
Okay, yeah.
And here's, so when you're
Rocket
in a room,
Man, 5 minutes.
That's what I'm saying. Like, and because these are movies that haven't aired elsewhere and there's no critical consensus about them, I don't think, let's say the people who make the movie, why wouldn't they get up and scream for it? You know what I mean? Like, because then that gets picked up. Do you sit in a room, a screening at Cannes, and think, I'm suspicious of everybody here and what they're actually reacting to and whether or not what I watched was actually good?
And how do you clap for 20 minutes?
Okay. There's a lot to talk about here. So there's two different sort of parallel tracks at Cannes. There's the press screenings and there's the premieres. The press screenings are famous in the other way because that's where people boo, which is really crazy to me. I mean, like, you know, like, I think the American way of not liking a movie is to, like, file out silently and then tweet about it. That is not the French method. Like, I've been sitting there watching movies that I actually liked or loved, and then after they end, people scream and boo and jeer and hiss, which is amazing. I remember there was a film called The Neon Demon that played there a couple years ago with Elle Fanning.
Right.
That movie is wild.
It was directed. It is very wild. It was directed by Nicholas Winding Refn. And the very last thing in the movie is his dedication to his wife. It says, for Liv. And a French journalist stood up and yelled, fuck you, Liv. I mean, that's how pissed they were. So
to be fair, the movie said, fuck you, Liv.
I mean, the movie is a troll job, and then the French press trolled him back. So you've got that going on in the at the, almost the same time, and sometimes literally at the same time, in a different theater, are the premieres. That is where everybody gets dressed up. That's when they're in their tuxedos and all their finery. And after those end, that is when the famous standing ovations happen. And they are truly crazy. Now, as you said, Lewis, like, yeah, obviously all these people are incredibly invested in giving themselves a standing ovation.
Yeah.
That has never been a problem for Hollywood. They love to, like, clap in their own honor. But this is, like, truly, again, like most things, it can take it to the extreme. Like, there's a video camera there that sort of goes, it's projecting what it shows on the big screen. So, you know, say at Rocket Man, you'll have the video camera. It'll be on Elton John. Everybody will applaud for Elton John. Mm. It will go to his right. There's Taron Egerton. Now to Richard Madden, now the director. So it's going, it's showing you every single one of these people. You can get maybe like 3 minutes of applause out of that. Then the camera will go back to the first person.
No way.
And applause start again. Then they kind of like nudge some of these people to like interact in combinations. Like, now, Taron, you hug Elton John.
Oh, God.
Now, Elton John, you hug so-and-so. It's truly
pageantry.
Crazy.
Yeah.
No, it goes on basically forever. And then sometimes it can wane and then come back.
That's
which is
like
ridiculous.
Overdone ovations in theater where, you know, like each actor comes out and then you clap for them, but then like the audience is still clapping, so they have to come back out and bow again.
Well, at least people kind of know what to do for that. It's like, now these people will come out. Now these people will come out. When Parasite premiered, that Bong Joon-ho film that won the Palm, you can see it because they even put it on YouTube. The standing ovation is going on so long that Bong starts talking to his lead actor. Like, he's like, I don't know what to do. This is so awkward. He turns to Tilda Swinton, who's behind him, and he's like, I'm hungry. Like, can this stop so we can go eat? It's crazy.
It has that, like, State of the Union feel. Just like, what are we doing? It's just noise.
Yeah. No, I mean, everything is amped up to, like, way past 11 at Cannes.
So I want to get into some controversy at Cannes. Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood had its world premiere at the film festival, and that is his film about Sharon Tate and the Manson murders and Hollywood in general, which is what all his movies are about anyway. A New York Times reporter, someone from, you know, your paper.
Yes, I've heard of it.
Asked Tarantino if it was a deliberate choice to give Margot Robbie's Sharon Tate much fewer lines than her male counterparts in the movie. And he responded, well, I just reject your hypothesis.
Yes. that's all he said.
Yes. And that Margot said, the tragedy ultimately was the loss of innocence. And to really show those wonderful sides of her, I think could be adequately done without speaking.
That is also the weirdest part of it. The tragedy is the loss of innocence? A murdered pregnant woman?
Also, a question isn't a hypothesis. A question doesn't necessarily require a hypothesis. You just like... It's an interview.
Mm-hmm.
You ask questions.
Yes. I mean, truly, this is the tip of the iceberg when it comes to things we're going to be talking about with this movie. This movie is going to be keeping the hot take industry in business all summer long.
AKA me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and listen, there's going to be plenty to talk about for good or for ill. This was actually the first Tarantino movie I left where I'm like, what did I think of that? Mm. Like, I felt it's a very long movie, first of all.
How long is it?
It's 2 hours 45.
Die,
I wanna
die,
say.
Die, die. Cut 45 minutes off
well,
of that movie.
3 hours
going,
shorter than
the
Hateful
Eight. He's going
back
and re-editing it, although he's kind of teased that he might just put in more stuff.
Oh, you don't say.
Yeah. It's leisurely. I'll say that. That was what was surprising about me. I watched that trailer and I'm like, okay, I get the zippy Tarantino movie this is going to be. And it's not really that. Mm-hmm. It's a lot more sort of relaxed. But yeah, this is a movie... I mean, there's a lot going on in this movie. One thing I can say is that the performances are great. Like, Leonardo DiCaprio is wonderful. Like, I appreciate that he's treating The Revenant as kind of like an aberration, and he's going back to what he did right before that with Wolf of Wall Street and Great Gatsby, where he's like, actually, I'm funny. Yeah. You know?
Like, you know what I think his best performance is Django Unchained.
Yeah, he's great in that
where it's
as
like,
well.
That character doesn't exist elsewhere to me.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
He's very funny, very poignant, but he understands like how to play those dramatic moments with a sense of humor. Brad Pitt is great in it. It's like the best use he's been out of a David Fincher film. So... You know, I like those. I like seeing Hollywood recreated. But there's a ton of other stuff where I'm like, oh, wow, okay, sure.
I mean, 2 hours and 45 minutes.
Yeah.
There's 45 minutes worth of stuff that, I mean, I've said this before. I'm like, a movie over 90 minutes, I need a good reason.
Correct.
A movie over 2 hours almost doesn't need to exist.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's fascinating how those 2 hours and change are used, you know? And especially, like, one of the things people are going to talk about when it comes to this movie is how it treats women. Now, mm-hmm. obviously, Tarantino has written some female characters that are iconic. Did he write that for Margot Robbie? Not necessarily.
Right, so the question here was, you know, like, a lot of people online were having this debate.
Oh, yeah.
Because
people who had not seen this movie.
Who doesn't
and
love
they were heated.
Who doesn't love a Memorial Day weekend debate in film Twitter about whether or not he treats his female characters, you know, well.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously he has The Bride, you know, people like Vernita Green, you know, he has Jackie Brown.
Uma Thurman in Pulp Fiction.
Yeah. You know, so he has those characters. But then you also have the flip side of that interview of Uma Thurman, where she talked about her horrible treatment on the set of Kill Bill, and then, you know, his association with Harvey Weinstein and other people like that, where you're just sort of like, what, Quentin Tarantino seems like a person who treats women horribly, so do we really think that his female characters are that great in retrospect?
Okay, so 2 points in response to this. One is kind of fucked up, so steel yourselves. You know, in that that article about Uma Thurman that you're referencing, she talks about how she drove this blue Karmann Ghia on the set of Kill Bill, and he asked her to drive it very, very fast, and it crashed and almost killed her, you know, which was an extremely traumatic thing that ended up being like a years-long rift between them. Brad Pitt drives a blue Karmann Ghia at top speed in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and it's, I guess, for Tarantino, the way he's framing it, it's like, look, it's the car from Kill Bill back again. And I just thought to myself, wouldn't you never want to see that car again after it almost killed your muse?
Right.
Yeah. But it's just like, I mean, I think that's how Tarantino operates. It's all about cinema love for him, and the real world like barely intrudes upon it. As we know, the real world does intrude on art, and the real world is going to intrude on the art that he has made here.
He's
when
literally
it comes
the killer
to
in
passing
death
judgment
birth
on it.
Well, he wants an actor dead.
I mean, listen, so there's a lot of stuff I won't get into because it's spoilery, but like treatment of women is a big deal in this movie. And when it comes to Margot's performance in this film, you know, the posters, the trailers would sell it like it's these three giant stars. And the reality of the situation is like she's not in it hardly at all. She's kind of treated more as this symbolic presence, like, you know, this beautiful, guileless, innocent woman. But like for the first hour of this film, she doesn't speak a single line, you know?
I think there's also something about this movie that I don't understand because it doesn't seem to really be about her. And I don't really gather what the story
is. Okay, so it's set in 1969, which is the year that the Manson family did kill off Sharon Tate, who's an actress who was dating Roman Polanski at the time. But the movie is a lot more about DiCaprio's character, who's this kind of like washed up star of Westerns, and Brad Pitt, who is his longtime stuntman. And they live next door to Polanski and Sharon Tate. So you see them every so often. Sometimes the camera will follow or the story will follow Tate. But it's really, really a lot more about these men. Mm-hmm. They are centered in the story with this sort of like undercurrent of the Manson family shit going on. And does it all come to a head later in the movie? Yes, but like in the maybe not in the ways that you're thinking, unless you're thinking that Tarantino does like to revise history a lot. And then in which case, maybe exactly the way that you're thinking.
It sort of seems like with Tarantino, if he's interested in a female character, he's really interested in her. Mm-hmm. And then beyond that, it's like you look at like Kerry Washington, Django Unchained, who didn't speak much either. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, when as opposed to just like women are half of the world. So almost any story to me involves women like most of the time, like they are a relevant part of the story being told, versus for him it's sort of like, well, this is about this, and so women, like, we don't need to, that's not what this is about, which feels like his response with Margot Robbie, which is like, well, that's not what the movie's about, which is, I get that line of thinking, that is not practically how people should be moving through the world.
Right. It's true and it's untrue, right? I mean, for that first hour when I was watching it, where I'm like, she has not said anything yet. I thought, okay, well, maybe this is the conceit of the film, that, like, she is someone who exists to be talked about by men but never fully understood, which, like, if that's where you're going to go, then okay, I get it as a concept. But then, like, she has a few scenes where she says a little bit. She still doesn't say that much. Mm-hmm. I mean, Lena Dunham has almost as many lines in this movie.
I forgot she was in this movie. I mean,
she's not Squeaky Fromm, though. That's Dakota Fanning.
No, that's
Fanning.
Dakota Fanning.
Yeah. What's interesting is that there's just sort of this concept, I mean, this Picasso thing, maybe, you know, of like men with women as muses, sort of in some way can see them as this powerful sort of artistic being that they can represent. It, you know, if you have an Uma Thurman in a Kill Bill, you know, a Pam Grier in a Jackie Brown, those are like, okay, I'm really elevating these women. But otherwise, you know, they think, if you're a person who thinks of women that way, you're also interested in a movie about men and showing just sort of how what happened to a woman affects their interior lives. And so it makes you sort of think that he's not ever really interested in women, just sort of the concept of how women make him feel.
He's interested in the concept of women.
I mean, listen, it's an extrapolation that some people will make. Mm. I love a lot of his other female characters. I think, you know, he treats them in a way that is complicated, but mm-hmm. at least some of these earlier characters I responded to. Like, I kind of mm-hmm. liken it to James Cameron, right? Like, he gave us so many iconic characters. Ripley in Aliens is amazing. Linda Hamilton in the Terminator movies.
But Kathy Bates and Titanic, moving right along.
But does that mean that we can't sort of look at, you know, Zoe Saldana and the way that she's treated in Avatar and, like, talk mm-hmm. about it? You know, I mean, it's relevant to have these conversations.
Well, even that, but, you know, like, Ripley was written as a man.
Yeah.
You know, and, like, then all you have to do is look at Jamie Lee Curtis in True Lies and it's like, you know, she's sure. stripping to get stuff happening in that movie.
My last question for you is, how many times did they say the N-word in this movie?
Shockingly, none.
There's
no black people in it at all.
Of course.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they weren't around.
In the 60s. Yeah. Not at all.
Not in Los Angeles.
But, you know, I mean, I think that idea of the male gaze, it's something that extends even beyond Tarantino that I saw all the time in Cannes. You know, I mean, there was this crazy movie, this 3.5-hour movie from the... I know, Kara. Like, this movie from the director of Blue is the Warmest Color.
Oh, yeah.
This instantly notorious fiasco that screened at Cannes this year called Mektub My Love Intermezzo. And it is basically 3.5 hours of watching women twerk. Like, what? Not just watching them twerk, but, like, literally the camera only being on their asses.
We already have that. It's called the internet.
Yeah, well, I mean, so this movie, yeah, I mean, ostensibly there's a story. It's kind of like following these young people on, you know, one crazy summer day where they're at the beach and then they go to the nightclub. But it is truly monomaniacal and
you
it's, like, single-minded. Yeah. Oh, boy. Yeah.
Oh,
3.5 hours of it. Like, and also, I mean, knowing what I know about Blue is the Warmest Color, where this director, Abdellatif Kashish, fought with his actresses about, you know, what they considered to be really exploitive working conditions, like a weird male gaze on this lesbian film, and, like, him making them do these scenes over and over and over. I just watched all this twerking in this movie being like, was there a paramedic on set? Can you die from twerking so much? Like, it was just terrifying to me. I don't know how these women survived the movie. I really don't. And I mean, it takes a break maybe 3 hours in for a 13-minute sequence of unsimulated oral sex. That still managed.
Oh my God.
Yeah, girl. 3 hours in, they like.
How the brown money.
Yeah, two of the characters go to a club bathroom and he goes down on her. And it still manages to be about her ass. I don't know.
Good
I mean,
God.
Like. Yeah, so.
Well, we all learned a lot.
Yeah.
Lastly, Antonio Banderas won for Almodovar's Pain and Glory.
Yes,
and I love Almodovar and I love Antonio Banderas. Is this good?
Oh, it's amazing. This is one of my favorite films of the festival. It's called Pain and Glory. Yeah, I love Almodovar, too. I feel like even like an okay Almodovar film, you still love watching it because he's got such confidence behind the camera and just the aesthetics of the thing.
Yeah.
The places people live, like the clothes that people are wearing. Yeah. It's kind of like Nancy Meyers movies for gay men. Mm-hmm. If Nancy Meyers movies aren't already Nancy Meyers
right, movies I was gonna for say.
Gay men. I'm doing the math.
I mean, one of his most problematic movies is still my favorite of his.
Which one?
Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down.
Oh, I mean, like, all of the Almodovar movies sort of are problematic if they're viewed in, like, that kind of way. But the movies are about like engaging with that sort of thing. You know, it's people on the fringes of society doing crazy shit. Mm. This movie is great because it's basically Antonio Banderas is playing Pedro Almodovar, like literally down to he's wearing Almodovar's clothes. Mm. He's living in Almodovar's actual apartment. And it's taking this filmmaker who's been so like punk rock for most of his career and picking up like kind of like in the later part of his life as he looks back on his life and career and his love affairs and all that. And
I like as he's been doing that in his career, like Broken Embraces.
Yeah, it made me realize like we see this kind of movie a lot, but directed by and about straight men. We even see it about straight men who are making it about straight male filmmakers, you know, like an 8.5 or somebody sort of going back over his career. And it's kind of amazing to see it about an older gay man because it's a perspective that I don't think is centered in a lot of these movies. So for an older gay man to be like, where am I in my life? How do I feel about it? How much am I still haunted by this love affair? What do I want to do with myself? You know, physically, if I'm reaching this point in my life, what does that mean for someone, you know, who's always relied on his beauty? And especially to see Antonio Banderas in this role, he's amazing.
I'm going to say, I'm also thrilled. It sounds like it's going to enter him into the Oscar contest, which is like, he's never really been in it before. And that's, and by the way, it's about time. I just love him.
Well, I mean, watching Banderas in this movie, you're like, wow, we've really like slept on him for a while. And instead of, you know, wanting to sleep with him. Mm-hmm. He's so fantastic in this movie and he's such a charming person in person. When he would go do interviews for this movie, everybody fell in love. So I think that if he can bring that charm offensive to the Academy, they're going to fall all over him. He's wonderful in it.
Call me Melanie Griffith because I love Antonio Banderas.
And I'm crazy in Alabama.
I have a great Antonio Banderas, Melanie Griffith story that I'll say after.
Kyle, thank you so much for being here. If more people want Kyle's film insights, he is the Carpetbagger columnist at the New York Times. And it does not mean you are a northerner who's gone down to the south to cause trouble.
But it is the number one thing that people ask me, why is it called Carpetbagger? Which I will briefly explain. David Carr, who was the original Carpetbagger columnist, he started covering film and he didn't really know the sort of lay of the land of award season. So he called himself the Carpetbagger. You know, he sort of jumped in like, I don't belong here, but I'll write about it. I kind of have been covering film in the industry for a while, but
it's
my job.
Yes.
But I like to say that I'm carpetbagging the opposite direction now because I live in Los Angeles, but I'm a New York Times columnist.
The wit.
Yeah. Levels. When we're back, we're going to talk about Booksmart versus Aladdin. Despite its brilliance, critical acclaim, and director Olivia Wilde appearing on this podcast, which has all of the power and influence in America.
Oh, yeah.
World.
Sure.
We are our own Netflix, I think.
Booksmart opened to a not-so-stellar $8.6 million at the box office. And, you know, the film was also up against Disney giant Aladdin and also John Wick 3.
And Avengers is still in
theaters. Yeah, Avengers is still out. And, I mean, John Wick 3 is iconic, as is the John Wick franchise. So it was going up against a lot of giants. But, you know, it was a surprising turn because critics and, you know, people on Twitter alike seem to really enjoy the movie. So it sort of begs the question, what types of movies are audiences willing to pay money to see in theaters now?
I sidestep this conversation to ask a petty question? Do we think the title Booksmart scared people off?
That's
if you think of a movie called Booksmart, do you think of what we saw on the screen there?
No, not necessarily. Mm-hmm. And you know, people are afraid of books.
Right.
Yeah.
Right,
so they're like, are they gonna make me read one to see the movie? That's a good
point.
Test. Yeah.
Will they be talking about Chaucer, Rabelais, and Balzac? No, that and also the idea that sure, there are giants now like Disney who make going to the movies an event, right? You know, so like the Marvel movies became a sort of, you had to see it to see the next one, you know? You had to see the culmination of Endgame. And then there's things like Aladdin, which, you know, like, trade on nostalgia, you know?
And it's a kid's movie. The whole, you can bring even the idea of if you want to go, if you're family, you want to go see Booksmart, the adults, mm-hmm. you have to get a babysitter mm-hmm. versus like, okay, we'll all go see Aladdin. We'll probably like it fine and the kids will like it. And that's, I mean, I don't know, movies are real expensive, but it's less of a kind of ordeal. Mm-hmm. And it's Memorial Day weekend, which is the other thing, which like on a random Friday night may not be your concern, but you're like, it's a holiday weekend. So presumably that's more in line with just sort of how people are approaching those few days.
Yeah. So is this the question now? Is it a sign of like Netflix and Hulu, you know, sort of filling that gap of like, you know, character-driven stories and people just wanting to stay home and watch movies? Or is it the factor of movies are expensive? You went up against a movie like Aladdin and Endgame is still out there. Also, it's Memorial Day weekend and people maybe just want to not spend time at the movie theaters anymore.
Yeah, I also was not like I thought the movie did fine. I mean, it didn't make, you know, the amount of money that people were like, I wanted it to make $100 million. You're like, okay, like, come on. But I didn't think it was like a failure. I thought mm-hmm. it was a smaller film. It's a comedy. It's like, it stars two, like it, I wasn't like, and considering what they, who they went up against. So I did not agree with this narrative of like, what happened? I'm like, well, mm-hmm. you sort of know what happened there. Yeah. But I think the other thing that people, you know, non sort of industry people don't think about or know or whatever, but it's just like the marketing of a movie and the extent to which that has an impact. And it doesn't matter how good the movie is. It really is. It's just an enormous factor. And I think you see with like, Will Packer's a really good example with like, they market those films very well. You Think Like a Man was like a case study for the strategy that they used to market that film, and it did very well. And so for better or worse, like that's just a really important component in all of these movies, which you don't think about when you're just like, I liked that movie a lot.
Mm-hmm. And if you don't have a big sort of like teen star in the movie to draw people in, not just the title, like, you know, we watched the film and I saw nothing about what I saw in the film in most of the advertising. And, you know, people try to compare it to like a female Superbad or like a Can't Hardly Wait. And I mean, like, you need to sell people on the atmosphere that this is a raunchy teen comedy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I can't stop thinking about how on Netflix, it really did seem like everybody I've ever met saw To All the Boys I've Loved Before, which is like not exactly similar to this movie, but has a lot of like similar components. Also, just as, from my personal experience, our friend Brendan Scannell is in this short web series called Bonding, which is about a dominatrix and like her assistant. And it's like, I saw it last summer, or like 6 months ago or so. And it felt like a smallish, but like, you know, fun enough thing. And it found its way to Netflix eventually. This weekend I was out with him. People would not stop coming up to him and saying, I know you from Bonding. And by the way, he spent the past year and a half on Heathers on TV Land, which, you know, ended up being kind of a fiasco. It's like, man, because this got to Bonding, this show, which would, I think, has a similar demographic than Booksmart in a lot of ways, he is just like super propelled. It is very strange that like all this media of this type for this kind of audience is ending up in one place.
I didn't the comparisons, because there was someone that was like, well, the movie did bad because everyone stayed home and watched Netflix, which is stupid and not true, because TV has always existed. There's obviously more television. But frankly, you were in a situation where it's like, oh, it's TGIF. They ain't showing this shit again. So I'm absolutely staying mm-hmm. home to watch it, as opposed to at any point in my life, I can turn on Netflix when it's convenient for me to watch something.
Right.
Like the idea that that's keeping people home in a way, I'm not sure that I believe or understand that. In particular with movies. With TV, I think it's different, but it's like as these streaming platforms have started to do more features, you know, they're getting more and more movies. Roma, obviously. But I don't think Netflix for me is still a place where you're like, the movie, like that's where I go to watch my movies. Yeah. I don't think of it that way. And so I just don't. And I think also like it's people going to movies in general. Mm-hmm. Like that is something that has been on a downturn for a while. And so it's not the idea that Hulu is responsible for it. I just don't understand the evidence people are presenting to back that up.
Because the benefit of a Hulu or a Netflix is the show you're watching, you can come back to because it's always going to be there.
Yeah.
You can step out for 2 hours if you want to. And Endgame is still making millions of dollars. Like, people are going to the movies.
Yeah.
It's just, how are you getting that audience in there? If I can say one thing about Endgame, as much as I love Marvel, the Russo brothers are, like, on Twitter being like, time to go see, like, the movie again, or, like, support your favorite characters and stuff. And I'm like, Disney, chill out. You already have all the fucking money.
Yeah.
Like, we know that you want to beat Avatar.
Yeah,
record.
I was going to say, is this about bumping up against Avatar?
But it's like, I'm tired of that, this level of, like, these blockbusters wanting to compete to, like, beat someone's sort of record and, like, sort of trying to incentivize fans to be like, oh, let's help this beat Avatar's record, et cetera. I'm like, I just want to see a good movie and be a fan of it. I don't need to participate in the capitalism game of helping you get several billion dollars.
I also have the distinct feeling that these fans are already incentivized enough. Have anybody been more incentivized in human history than these fans?
You know, I think part of it, too, I think the response, because if you're looking at, like, people on Twitter and you're looking at writers and film people, they're like, well, Aladdin made $100 million. And it's like, of course it did. Mm-hmm. I don't know what's surprising about that. And I think that because we are like, we like Booksmart more. Mm-hmm. And like, that's a movie that I enjoyed and whatever. If you look at just the demographic of America, more people are going to go see Aladdin and John Wick than not just this movie, but then a lot of movies. Mm-hmm. So I also found that to be confusing where it's like, what did, how did you, you didn't think Aladdin was going to do well? That's fucking Will Smith. It has like one of the largest movie stars on the planet who continues to like, is still out here making movies that make a lot of money, whether or not we're watching them or whatever. It's like, and it's in a beloved franchise and a Disney movie.
My and question, also a live, and like there hasn't been a live action movie movies action, that hasn't done,
yeah,
has done poorly.
Has done a lot, has made a lot of money. So you can't be like, what happened with Aladdin? Like, I don't know. It was tailor made to make, a, that was the whole point was for it to make a stupid amount of money because that's what Disney does.
And my question then would be to Annapurna, who made Booksmart, what the fuck would you release Booksmart against Aladdin? You know, it's like, because it's like I get counter programming, but that's not putting Sex in the City up against like a horror movie or like an action movie. You know,
I feel like John Wick 2 might have been more because that I feel like that age. Mm-hmm. I could imagine a world where I would be with like a boyfriend and deciding between Booksmart and John Wick more than Booksmart and Aladdin.
And one thing that is sort of beautiful about Aladdin making all this money, one, it proves that Will Smith can still like get people to theaters on a holiday weekend because historically that was his
thing.
That's
his weekend,
yeah. He would open up on like 4th of July, holiday weekends and show that people will, you know, leave their barbecue or whatever to go see a Will Smith movie. But, you know, it has brown leads in it, you know, because so it's like,
Not even just leads, like most of the people in that movie are not white people.
So you've got a bunch of brown people in a movie making $100 million, and it's like, that's great, I think.
It's a Nassim Pedrad vehicle for me, so understand that.
So I think that people are sort of ignoring that beautiful part about it. And also, there are some really great people of color with some roles in Booksmart, but I didn't see nary one of them in the trailers for the movie.
Oh, so, that's interesting.
You know, people probably didn't go see Booksmart who would have enjoyed that, who didn't know that
Jessica Williams.
Is in the movie. Austin Kroot, who plays the black gay teenager, and also, you know, didn't really even highlight a lot of the queer elements.
Yeah,
of
Noah
the movie
Galvin
too.
Is great in that movie.
Yeah, so, you know, it's like, lead with your diversity and getting a niche audience who wants to go and support that movie. Make people want to stan your movie to go see it. I think that it just ended up, you know, going up against some bigger movies. And then people online decided to be like, take off their little thinking caps and be like, I know, it's Netflix.
Yeah. And just the idea that it's like, I don't want to use the word failure because I do not believe that, but that's what you see people saying. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like that just, it felt like people just wanting to have something to talk about. And I think also, like, again, it's a movie that if you really loved the movie, you want to see things that you love succeed and do really well. But, you know, that's not always the case. So have your love for the movie. Like, oh, my God, I still very much enjoyed it. I want to see it again. I'm so happy it got made. You know, it's not fully validated by a box office.
And $8.6 million, you're right, like, seems perfectly appropriate given what other movies that are like this have been making lately, you know? And I mean, if they had been able to stick, like, you know, Noah Centineo in it or something, or like even a bigger star as the lead, maybe it would have made slightly more money.
Can we, maybe some of these movies, can they just stick the word Marvels in front of it? Like Marvels yeah. Love Simon. Just like, it won't hurt. Be nice. Just do it.
Disney's.
Because, yeah. you know, when people were also comparing it to Superbad, mm-hmm. it was marketed as in the universe of Judd Apatow, mm-hmm. who at that point had made successful movies. So it's not surprising. Like, that movie, I don't know, is the best example. Like, I get it in terms of the content of they're out for the night and whatever, and they're mm-hmm. young. But, like, it had the stars that it had, and you're like, if you liked Knocked Up, go to Superbad. I mean, that's a pretty convincing way to get people to go see a movie.
And also, that movie had come out somewhat, like, a year before then, you know?
Right, exactly. So it was really, like, riding the momentum of that. So, like, I just feel like people wanted a different outcome, which I fully get and also agree with and very much feel. But then I think their rationalization and their explanations for it just, like, didn't really make sense.
Mm. All right, well, if you have not seen Booksmart, go see it because it's great.
It's so good.
Yeah, I would tell you if it sucked. It's yeah. great. Yeah.
First of all, one of the biggest problems with Hollywood movies is the second week drop off. So
right.
go see the fucking movie this weekend
right.
if you want to support it. Or Rocket Man or whatever you want to see. Do you. When we're back, keep it. And we're back with our favorite segment of the episode. It's Keep It. Keep It Up last week was a little too positive for me, so
it was disgusting.
Yeah, I'm ready to dive into Keep It to talk about some shit that we don't like again. Lewis, you look like you're on the edge of your
pissed.
Seat.
Yeah. Well, also, we just spent an entire weekend in Palm Springs, and I am so sleep deprived. I feel like a petrified Georgia O'Keeffe cow skull. So pardon me as I reanimate. My Keep It this week is to, I think, definitively my least favorite Oscar winner of all time, John Voight. And I include the movies Suicide Squad and Love Story. Love Story might be the original baby boomer onslaught on America, by
Love
the way.
Love Story is a disgusting, awful
the mess.
Movie. And the tagline, love means never having to say you're sorry, is wild.
Abusive. It's disgusting. So John Voight basically just released a PSA. John Voight, by the way, the father of Angelina Jolie.
That's all he's done.
Right. He produced Angelina Jolie is what you need to know.
Thank you for that.
But he is also, unfortunately, a film legend. Was in Midnight Cowboy, won an Oscar for Coming Home, which means he won an Oscar for a movie co-starring Jane Fonda, which is the cruelest fate ever. And Jane, of course, won for that, too. But anyway.
By the way, Jane Fonda was the reason I lost a trivia round last night.
I can't believe I have to strangle you on air.
Well, you had to list actors or actresses who have won Best Actor or Best Actress who also have a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
Oh.
And I confused Jane having handprints on the Walk of Fame with a star.
Oh, the Chinese theater.
Yeah, because some celebrities have their name and the handprint, but mm-hmm. they don't have an actual star.
Oh, but she does have a star. But does Sally have a star and she appeared for... because she's friends with Sally Field.
When I Googled Jane Fonda Hollywood star, she's shown up at many celebrities' star unveilings, but right. she does not have one herself.
Wow. The degradation. Anyway, so John Voight just released a PSA being like, we have to support our president. And a couple of things came to mind. One, this man is jockeying to play Donald Trump. They frankly just look alike, and he would do this, and he has given us a bullshit impression before. He was nominated for that movie Ali, playing Howard Cosell. What a crock of shit. And secondly, we just need to stop paying attention to certain completely out of touch white men. I mean, Angelina Jolie will tell you herself, don't listen to my father. So that's all we need to say about that. But anyway, he's just the worst. Why listen to him? And yet we did. He was trending all weekend. So that's
why,
enough.
Like, who cares?
Right.
About John? Like, who's like, oh, John Voight said so. I assume the people that were thrilled by the Clint Eastwood chair situation.
When are we getting that movie, by the way? Clint Eastwood and the chair.
It honestly just feels like these old men, I don't know how the brains are doing. The older you get, it's not their fault. Like, it's when you get old.
Yeah, atrophy.
Yeah, it's just what happens. And it just feels like no one is stopping them. No one's like, come on, John, why don't you go see if your grandkids will talk to you this week? Because you know those kids are like, Mom, who's that? She's like, eh.
Also, yeah. Them along with notorious creep James Woods.
They just another brilliant actor, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, not anymore.
Yeah, no, Salvador is what I mean, not now.
I feel like there was a slew of men and some women in Hollywood throughout like the 60s, 70s. They were great actors, obviously, but we didn't really talk about politics like of celebrities in the news and the media. So they probably just like annoyed people at parties, right? Talking about their politics.
On set, yeah, like, ugh, yeah, got it.
Being like, ugh, do you really think Nixon should be resigning? Fuck them Democrats.
John loves the Vietnam War, guys. He's like all for it.
But now that we know, and now that they have access to recording videos or tweeting, now we know like how trash they've always been.
Right. And if they can get that retweet from Chuck Woolery, they're going
to
do it.
And they are excited to talk about it with other people who they feel like support them now. So the real problem is we just need to make them all go back in the closet as Republicans.
Who gave them a Twitter? What person under the age of 35 took the job of facilitating John Voight's Twitter?
Right, because we know that like young gays tweet for most of these people, like Dionne Warwick, who had her fight.
Dionne Warwick, when she suddenly gained the ability to post very deep memes, I was like, I don't know what's happening here.
Talking about Beyonce, how she's not an icon yet, and then responding to everyone on Twitter who was agreeing with her. And like, she sent me a GIF, Nick Kroll in his publicity get up that sketch. And so I was like, some gay is running this account.
No.
So I want to know who is running the accounts of these old men. Is it like Charlie Kirk?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, judging based on the grammar alone, it might be them. So okay. I don't know.
Wow. Kara, what is your keep it this week?
Well, since I missed the positive keep it moment, mm-hmm. And in the spirit of Lewis's, he really just wants to talk about something he likes.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it clever of me?
The gymnastics to get to it. I'm going to do something like that, which is to anyone who hasn't yet watched Fleabag season 2, mm-hmm. which is 6 perfect episodes of television. Phoebe Waller-Bridge is a literal genius. This word is often used, genius, brilliant, words that are thrown around much too frequently just for the state of anything. Not that much shit is brilliant, guys. Do you know what that word means? It's a rare, rare usage. But I think we often use it to talk about men who just make, you know, male characters who are like brooding and whatever the fuck, but are terrible people. And they call it an anti-hero. And suddenly that seems important.
It's called the entire 1970s right. in film. Yes.
Phoebe Waller-Bridge is an actual genius. Fleabag is actually brilliant. It's like these characters and the relationships they're looking at, and like between sisters and between, she fucking falls in love with a priest, guys. Like, come on.
Everyone is talking about the hot priest on the internet. Yeah. Andrew Scott.
It's also just like a really, it's just like, it's such a great love story, which doesn't make any sense. Like if you were like, hey, you're going to get in deep with this, like, this badly behaving woman and a priest, I'd be like, no, I'm not. Mm. But
well,
here I am.
I've seen the Thornbird, so maybe so.
Love me some Stanley. Also, I mean, after this show, I almost think they have to retire Breaking the Fourth Wall altogether because she is so amazing at it.
And they do something incredible with Breaking the Fourth Wall at the end of the series that I will not spoil for you. And it's just so smart. And the other thing is the actual restraint, like I love a lot of British television, and it's really frustrating sometimes when there's 4 or 6 episodes or just you want more. But this was something where it is so tight. It is so perfect. It's 12 episodes. And she's like, I'm not doing a third season. I absolutely don't think she should. Like, she created something that just like, that's what it is. I feel the same way with like Russian Doll, where mm-hmm. I was like, oh, that was perfect. Mm-hmm. And so for as much as like with TV now, you're like, oh, these short orders and you want more. Like sometimes people take that and say like, I'm going to create for the medium and I'm going to make a story that is perfect for 6 episodes or perfect for 12 episodes. And I thought she really did that well. And it's so good.
And
it's
along those lines, I am afraid for the new Big Little Lies. Like it could have just ended there. Yeah, we would have been great.
Yeah,
you know.
It's just not every story. The thing is, you kind of have to know from the beginning. Like if you start a story and it's like, oh, we've unfolded it in 10 episodes. Now give us 10 more. That's hard as opposed to like, hey, by the way, you're going to need to keep this going for 5 seasons. You obviously go in and start setting up the story that way. So I think it's also just not the way that writers write. Mm-hmm. Like, I think if you're coming up with the story, you're either thinking of something complete and you're writing a movie or whatever it is, or you're leaving things open. And so to just sort of like change your mind halfway through is weird. And it does not, as we've seen, it does not always work out.
You know, the only thing I think that needs to be 60 plus episodes is Love Island, which is back this summer.
There you go.
Well, aren't there like 600 episodes, period?
It airs every night.
Oh my God.
And it is coming back.
No, like 7 days a week? Or on weekends too, or
six
five?
Days, 6 days a week, 5 days a week, and then there's a recap episode on the weekend in case you missed the week.
Of course you miss the week. It's every fucking day.
But that is coming back this June to the UK. But also, I believe in the same week, CBS's version of Love Island is debuting, and that's going to be on.
It's going to be every day?
Julie Chen hosting?
I don't know who's hosting it. I don't think they've announced it.
Okay.
But yeah. So it's going to be a lot of Love Island this summer.
I can't imagine watching a recap episode of a 5-episode-a-week show.
Well, I never watched the recap episodes because I just breezed.
Why wouldn't you just
ones.
Watch the recap episode?
Oh, yeah, or just that, yeah.
Well, I mean, then you miss all the banter.
Okay.
Can they recap all the time you didn't spend with your family? How about that? Talking about values now.
I have no family.
Okay.
You know that they were murdered by John Voight. My keep it this week is to Utah County Commissioner Nathan Ivey.
Okay. He's always up in my business.
He's
County Commissioner? I don't even know what that is.
He is always trying to steal monuments. Carmen San Diego is shook. Now, he is a Mormon Republican lawmaker who came out this week. I'm gay. I love when that happened, used to happen on People magazine or Time, you know, Ellen and Lance Bass.
Yeah, Lance Bass. Yeah.
Anyway, he's come out and basically he's just talking about how you can be part of the Church of Latter-day Saints and be gay and be Republican and it all works out. And I'm like, shut the fuck up.
If you like violently throwing up every day.
First of all, he talks about struggling with knowing he was gay since he was 9. So I'm like, I mean, well, congrats on still becoming a Republican and supporting.
Defiant.
Right. You know, supporting a political party that
hates you.
And this is sort of that weird thing of like him trying to say, you know, I think that people always think it's at odds to be gay and Republican, but it's not. I'm like, I don't think it's at odds because there are a lot of evil gay Republicans like Peter Thiel or that Aaron Schock who got away with committing crimes in Illinois and did not go to prison.
Now he's terrorizing Barry's boot camp in West Hollywood.
Yeah, and just hanging out at the Standard.
Yep.
Leaking his nude photos all over the city, which he probably did on purpose, by the way.
Oh, really?
You know, it was just everyone was concerned this weekend about that Aaron Schock's nudes were leaking. And they were like, oh, my God, this must be so embarrassing to him. And I'm like, I would posit that he actually enjoys it.
Wait, that's impossible. An insta-looking gay enjoying spreading naked pictures of himself. You're crazy.
He's like, I won't make him sign up for an OnlyFans. I'll give it to all my fans. but no, I'm just sort of like the idea of this Mormon Republican from this church, which we've all seen Big Love. I don't know if they still do that, but...
Jennifer Goodwin, come back to us.
Your church was up to no good. The Republicans are up to no good.
Well, the thing about this that I find so like uninteresting is it's not surprising when usually a white person is a part of a political group that doesn't have their best interests in mind. You look at all poor white people who are Republicans. They don't like you or care about you and are actively trying to hurt you. You look at white women who are Republicans, like the bitch who signed the heartbeat bill. It's like, it's not surprising that this person who is either greedy or who is, you know, only looking out for themselves or whatever it is would be a part of two groups that don't like him. That's like, yeah, man, there's a lot of people who do that shit. You're not special. You still suck.
It's usually just that they hate some other group so much.
So much that
they
want
to support it. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
You know, and they think that they won't be attacked.
And they think that being, like, if they're able to marginalize other people, then their marginalization won't be paid as much attention to, or it makes them less marginalized if, like, you're a white woman in a party and you can, like, step on black people. It makes you feel like you're less marginalized or you have some sort of power. Like, this is not new psychology with these idiots.
And T, he is a full-grown ass adult who is still a Republican. So my reasoning or hypothesis of why he came out with this I'm gay video is that somebody knew and it was about to come out.
Right, right.
So let me get ahead of the story.
I think we can all agree there's a diversity of hypocrisy among white Republicans. And I'm glad to see that representation, finally.
Yeah, I'm glad it's in Utah. Right. The only hypocrite we had from there for a minute was Mitt Romney.
He's still, you know, anytime I remember that Mitt Romney went out there again, what is he, governor or senator? Senator. I mean, like, come on, man.
You know, you went from losing to Obama.
Badly.
Very poorly. And also teaming up with an even bigger loser, Paul Ryan. And then coming out against Donald Trump. Then having dinner with Donald
That's
Trump.
That's my favorite photo.
Bend the knee.
Him, like, caught in the headlights with his little knife and fork. Like, they just caught him. Is so funny and is so... I don't think he realizes how embarrassing it is for him, which sort of takes away a little bit of the joy. But I'm like, you could not look more spineless, and I love it. And you've been caught.
Well, what I love about this Nathan Ivey person now
That's
is...
That's his name?
Yeah, is okay. That I feel like... Some Republican is going to be like, cool, you've got Pete Buttigieg out here. You know, the Democrats are trying to be like, we can have a gay person who's very prominent in the party now. I feel like Nathan is now going to become that Mitt Romney. Someone's going to pull him into, like,
what is he
having like? To compromise himself even further just because they're like, oh, we can put a gay Republican out there in
right.
the forefront. And...
He's the city commissioner?
I feel he probably wants more.
Is that what
more.
It is?
He probably wants
I
more.
I mean, I'm sorry to civics teachers around the country. I don't know what the fuck a city commissioner is.
This is like
it's
one
not of, mayor. I know that.
This is like one of the actual occasions where I actually think sexuality doesn't matter. It's like, oh, you suck. That's where the story ends.
Yeah,
and you're not interested like, in any other way.
Yeah. Nothing about these dummies is interesting. And it's annoying that they think it's interesting. Like, he thinks now... Like, oh, you're shitty like a bunch of other people are shitty.
Right. No, he's like, I'm horrible, but I also can cook.
Yeah. I mean, commissioners basically just like control like, you know, general stuff in the city, like taxes,
how can
and
he...
ordinances.
So what city? Well, he can't be the city commissioner of Utah. So he's the city commissioner of...
Utah County.
What?
I bet that's one of the prominent counties in Utah.
Where's Tommy? Tommy, I need some flashcards because I don't know what any of this stuff is. I've also never been to Utah, so I don't.
Where is Pod Save Utah? So I can figure out what the fuck is going on in this city. Anyway, he sucks. Gay Republicans suck. Aaron Schock sucks. Everyone sucks.
We did it.
That's it. Guess we're back to being negative again. Thanks again to Kyle Buchanan for joining us. We'll see you next week.